copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, I have a premise that with the Enlightenment came the concept of progress, and that progress became an end in itself in the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment stands at least on two pillars. One, that the past, or I should say the future, or the present, is always superior to the past, and the way to knowledge is reason only. Now, I'm not concerned with the last. I am concerned with the first, for I think it is the one place where evangelicals have not thought through the implications of how progress has influenced our culture. And so that's really what I'm going to argue for. I shouldn't say argue, because it's not going to be a very strong argument, but I will raise some possibilities about this matter of progress and what we now see in our cultures, and particularly in the Western world, but not just in the Western world, because it's just about everywhere I look. I don't just lecture in Eastern Europe, in Europe as a whole, also in Africa, as well as in the States. Now, with this notion that new is always better than what is old, what we have then is eventually what will develop is this idea that choices are everything. Now, you think about today, what does your culture want to give you? Choices. And if you can think of a sort of as a microcosm of all of this, look at the mall. The mall is a clear example of modernity, where you go in, you have choices, right? You have multiple stores, they're all under one roof, and you are the consumer. And the everything is set up to make sure you remain the consumer, all right? So you go to the mall, and you're thinking, well, I'm just going to go and buy a pair of shoes. But when you leave the mall, you have packages much larger than would accommodate a pair of shoes. Why? Well, because the ethos of consumerism, and we'll talk a little bit about that, really influences our behaviors. Now, what I want to show is how that is in culture, and now how it has made its way into the church, and how is it affecting the church as a whole. Now, so one thing that progress gives us are choices. The second thing is, if you're going to have progress, then you've got to make some kind, you must have some way to measure it. Okay? How do we know that we've moved forward? Well, we do it by twin criteria. One of them is convenience, and the other one is efficiency. Now, obviously, all of us love convenience, right? And we all like efficiency. But I'm going to argue that that ethos, which we'll call the ethos of consumerism, is really pretty much contrary to the Christian way of living. How is it that if these are the twin criteria for when progress happens, and now progress is everything, and that gets into the church, I think it's no wonder that we find young people who lack little sense of commitment, and certainly very minimum commitment to sacrifice. Why not? Because even in the church, these ideas of efficiency and convenience are very much creating what I would call the ethos of consumerism in the church. And now the church leaders are going to come back and say, but we're still preaching the same message. And I'm going to say, which do you think has more power over your congregants? The message you preach or the ethos you have created? And I will tell you that not in every case, but it is the ethos that is created. Now, I've been a pastor, was a pastor, for 30 years. I taught, that was my second job, and then someday I just decided that I'd done enough pastoring, and now I just teach full time. Now, when we think about efficiency and convenience, that brings up another problem. Or at least it seems to be a problem, and that is, how do we measure convenience and efficiency? And that, we then see a shift, and the shift moves from measuring things qualitatively to measuring things quantitatively. So when do we know that we've been efficient in the church? Well, it's when we have reached more people than we reached yesterday. Now, I'm not against reaching many people, but what ends up happening is that if we look at a program, we only look at the program in terms of quantitative measurement. That is convenience and efficiency. But how do we know when we have achieved that? Well, we have a bigger building, we have more people, we have more money in the coffers. And while I'm not suggesting that those are bad in and of themselves, what is now missing so often even in the church, to say nothing of our culture, is the whole idea of the qualitative, what we generally call character. So you can't measure character with a great economic calculator. Okay, so we try to do that. So this ethos of consumerism, and I've suggested where you kind of get the idea of it by looking at the mall where merchants of cool peddle their latest and new product, that will cause humanity to flourish, they tell us. Think about this. Think when Apple says to us, now I'm pretty bad on technology, so you just have to excuse me, but Apple says we're going to have a new iPhone, right? Now, the fact of the matter is, it's iPhone 0.005. That's the newest. Now, the fact is that iPhone 0.005 really isn't any better than the iPhone 0.004. But guess what? It's new. So people will line up two nights before or so, camp out, in order to get what? A better product? Not necessarily, but they will get a new product. So that kind of gives you what's going on in our larger culture. And I would say, if you look at in the church, where do we see that sort of thing developing? It's, well, the pastor goes off to a seminar and he gets a new product, he gets a new method. And we scrap the old method and we put in a new method. We're always looking for the new. And then when you think about preaching, oh, the poor preacher is always got to be coming up with something new. I mean, who wants to preach the old, stale, historic message of the gospel? Something new. Well, why do we have to do that? Well, because the congregants are used to that every day in their of their life. So I would argue that this ethos of consumerism has made its way into the church, and it disorders and interferes with a sense of peace and contentment. I say it makes us as humans like a song that's sung off tune, because it diminishes humanity to merely a consumer, where a person is sacrificed for profit, where beliefs are more likely to be talked about than acted upon. And I could give some examples. The ethos overpowers the good judgment, just as it does in the mall. And we do not ask, and here's a key question, what is gained, what is lost? That's always a key question to be asked. What is gained, what is lost? If I'm going to take on something new, what is gained, what is lost? Now, if you only answer that question in qualitative terms, quantitative terms, I think it's going to skew your evaluation of what you're going to accept. I think you must also consider the fact of the qualitative. Now, I think evangelicals have warned well against materialism of the age, but they did it all the while they were embracing standards of efficiency and convenience that were driving the materialism. So on the one hand, there's this strong argument against materialism, and yet the ethos that we build in the church is very much an ethos of consumerism, which encourages materialism. So church accept the controlling ideas of convenience and efficiency, and assessing the use of technology in the church. Again, I want to say I'm not against technology. I'm not a Luddite, and I'm not against things that are efficient, and I'm not against things that are convenient. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that when they become the sole standards by which we make decisions about how we do church and how we live our lives, I just think they are impoverished criteria for such an important decision. So we end up having, the church ends up having to cater to people who have lived 6 days of their life under the ethos of consumerism. So when they come into church, they've got to have a lot of choices, right? They've got to know how many Sunday school classes or whatever you call them do we have to have. Well, we've got to have one for everybody who wants a different thing. You know, I don't go to this church because they don't give me enough choices. There's only two Sunday school classes, and I need more than two Sunday school classes. And so the church has to accommodate. Now, I think the church's ideas, its intentions, are impeachable. And I think they're right. But I think it's the uncritical behavior that brings the spirit of progress in within the church, which I would say really stands against the ethos of the kingdom of God, which is an ethos of commitment and sacrifice. I could go on to say how they have actually been using it, that is technology. But let me just, without talking about particulars, raise this question of what does technology do to us? See, there are the two questions that need to be asked. One, what is gained? What is lost? The other question is, there's another question. Hopefully it comes to me. What is technology doing for us? And what is technology doing to us? Technology is doing something to us as well as for us. So we must ask that question. How has technology shaped your view of reality? Enormously. I'm going to suggest that when I think about technology, I'm going to think mainly of media technology. I'm not talking about medical technology. You know, I'm not talking about technology that can build a nice building or anything like that. Primarily, I'm talking about media technology. Okay. Unfortunately, I think that the church thinks that as long as their message has stayed the same, that all is well. There is this general view that the medium has nothing to do with the message. And I think a strong case can be made that the medium is a message. So if you think about social media as an example, Facebook, I say, oh my, we're not going to get another diatribe against Facebook. Well, but what I would say is that we are now thinking that a friend is somebody who follows us on Facebook, but that's redefined the whole concept of friend. I could mention some others, but time is not going to permit. But the concern I have is that the church simply says, oh, we'll use this and we'll use that, without ever asking the question, what is gained, what is lost, or what is that doing to us? And what is it doing for us? Now, I'm not going to make a case here, but I just raise this as another concern. Simulcast. So a pastor sits in one building and preaches, and then it is telecast to maybe three or four other locations. And so the people sitting in that audience are hearing the same message, right? Same pastor, same man speaking. They're hearing the same message, but they're not hearing the same message. They're getting the same information. But the pastor who's preaching is actually, he's actually reacting to his congregation. He's watching faces. You just do this naturally. And so he's shifting, and the people in the audience can actually see the pastor. But those on simulcast get none of that. So I'm saying you aren't delivering the exact same thing. Now, maybe I'm not saying that's bad. I'm only saying we need to be thinking about, well, what is gained, what is lost. Certainly it's efficient, and certainly it's convenient. But is that really all there is to it? I think if unchecked in time, I'm wondering what will actually happen to our preaching if we are only concerned about delivering information. Now, those of you, any of you in education, you know education is coming under the same kind of a problem. I would hold distance learning and all the rest of it. I think in the end, faithfulness to Christ as the truth must guide our steps. And faithfulness at its very deepest level, commitment to our God, where sacrifice and challenge everything on the easy road of convenience and efficiency, no matter what we think it buys us. And that we must live this way, even if it makes us fools for Christ. We think, where do we stand against our culture? We always think, oh, I'm going to stand against the culture. You know, I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to chew, and I'm not going to go with those who do. I'm not going to watch television. No. But maybe there's a place for all of that. But we aren't giving any attention to what is going on technologically in our culture that is actually affecting us as evangelical Christians. I think we have to think about everything. Anytime we are going to say, oh, we're going to do this, we need to ask ourselves the question, are we only evaluating something new on its quantitative benefits? Have we asked ourselves the question, what is gained, what is lost? Have we asked ourselves the question, how is technology, not only what is it doing for me, but what is it doing to me? Now, the whole thing of community, right? But if we begin to, you know, if we think that we can actually, I know churches now who actually counsel using Facebook. And I really raise a question about that. What is lost to this concept of face-to-face? You know, Lewis had this great saying, that friends walk side by side, lovers face to face. Is there something that is gained in face-to-face communication that cannot be gained any other way? Now, here I am talking about that, and we're going to be taping this, and there are going to be people watching it. So I'm not saying, you know, we ought to just, you know, tear apart everything and go back to sandals and robes and walk everywhere we go. I'm not saying that at all. I am asking us as evangelicals to think a little more carefully and more critically about what we employ and how we employ it. It just might be that we're going to say, this is not that good for us. The gain is not worth what we're losing or what it's doing to us. So and just as I stop, let me say there's this. there are churches, for example, who now allow you to give your tithe, whatever you call it, by bank draft. Okay. Now, you can't deny that's efficient, right? And it's surely convenient. But what does it do with the whole concept of giving? I don't have to think about it, right? I just tell my church, here's my bank number, just draft whatever you need every month. But I'm asking, what does it do to the physical notion of actually giving? So that's just a kind of an example of what I'm thinking, all right? So I've said that and my time is up. So comments or questions?
I'm a missionary to France. I've been there for 28 years.
Okay.
And one of the hardest struggles I've had in my ministry is to try to deal with the pressure coming from the States of producing great numbers. Yeah. Matter of fact, I almost lost my job over it one time. It got so serious. But it has been, and my wife is probably still suffers a little bit because of that. It's just the pressure that just there. And really, some people really mean, there was a time when there were some pastors in our mission that was claiming that we should just simply shut down the work in France because it wasn't producing.
Yeah, now this is just a kind of like a testimony of how the great economic calculator is determining whether or not you are successful as a missionary. Again, do we want numbers? Would we like to see 25 people come to Jesus every hour? Well, of course we would. But when we use that as the only criteria, then it does put that kind of pressure, even if there's a larger statement by a mission agency that, no, that's not the case. The fact is, the influence tends to get very subtle. So it's a very, I find it is a very delicate balance that we have here. My concern is the church isn't even thinking about this. They are not considering what kind of an impact this is having on the body of Christ. And I think, in particular, the issues of sacrifice and the issues of commitment. But churches today find it difficult to have people commit to maybe more than a month. I remember when I was first pastoring, the piano player. She'd been playing the piano for the last 25 years. And when she went on vacation, she was always back for Sunday. And it wasn't because she's the only lady to play, okay? But now you say, well, gosh, that's really over the top. Yeah, well, maybe it is. But it just at least shows where we have come from and how we have to now give out things in small lots to people. So, yeah. The statement here is that when young people come to the UK and, well, why are you here? Well, study the culture. Well, what it really means is, how do we shop in the UK? Yes. This is, yeah. So how do we engage the young people? How do we get the older generation, my generation, how do we get the older generation to include and get in the younger generation and invest them with some responsibility? Well, that is, I think I have 8 minutes left. I'm not sure that 8 minutes is going to be able to do justice to that wonderful question. But first of all, I'm going to challenge the notion of the youth culture. Peter Bergler out at Notre Dame has written a book, The Juvenilization of American Christianity. I think that we have put too much weight on attracting the youth culture by giving them a sanctified version of what they have in the church. I mean, what they have in the culture. Now, I think that this, an older generation, such as my generation, you know, you just get to church and shut up and sit down, okay? Well, there's probably a time for that. Young people, Richard Weaver wrote about this in a book back in the 50s on what is the advantage of youth? Well, great advantage of youth. And youth are the ones that we must impart information that's going to be crucial to society moving forward in their generation. I'm not sure we're doing that. I think we've tried so hard to get the young people in and to keep them that we have actually done them a disservice. I suspect, and this is not just something I've thought about or dreamed up, that young people really are interested in having the deep questions answered, but we've never stopped long enough to actually do that with them. We're afraid they won't come back to church. So I want to find a balance there. Youth is wonderful. They have good ideas, but some of those good ideas need to be filtered through ages of maturity and memory and saying, you know, that's a really good idea, but you have to understand wisdom is going to tell us that that's not the best way to go. But you've got a good idea. Let's see if we can achieve it by some other means. So it's not an either-or where we lock all the young people in the youth building and don't let them out till they've all acquiesced that they're Christians and they're gonna obey mommy and daddy. So there needs to be a dynamic there that goes on. But my concern is that evangelicalism has capitulated to the youth. And that's a pretty new idea. and we keep telling our youth, you're going to change the world. That is one of the most absurd claims that anybody can make. So we're putting all of our eggs in the basket of youth. And so that's why we got to keep them coming, because they're the answer to, you know, our survival. I don't think we've thought about that as, you know, as the older generation. So I'd argue for a balance. I think we need to be very straight with young people. You're not driving the bus. You will have a day when you drive the bus. I'm reminded of 1 John. I think it's in chapter 5. It may not be chapter 5, but it's where John talks about the young man, the young man, the children, the young man, and the old man. There seems to be sort of an order here that young people, the younger generation, are maturing under the older generation while the older generation is here. I think my generation did not do a good job of helping to mentor, disciple, and encourage the younger generation. Now we've got the idea. I just tweeted. Can you believe that I tweet? Well, only occasions. The idea is, it's easy to criticize the past when you only see what's wrong with the present. And so the young people see a lot of things that are wrong, and they're right about the things that are wrong. But that doesn't mean that the entire past should be cut off, but that's the way they're thinking. They're thinking new is better. We've got a new program, we've got a better program, but we've encouraged that mentality, that ethos in our churches. It's a wonderful question. I suggest that we as evangelicals really need to come together and give that kind of a question some serious thought about how do we do this, because I think the present trend that I'm seeing, it's not going to end up well either for the older people or for the younger people. And there isn't an effort among some, not all, but some, to drive a wedge between the two generations. So now we have the younger generation meeting over here and the older generation meeting over there. Because, you know, the old stodgies, they've got to have one kind of thing, you know. And the young people got to have something else. We are the family of God with the body of Christ. So, yes. The idea is, well, let me just talk about medium and message, form and content. Form shapes content. Students say, no, it doesn't. I say, okay, let's just suppose that I live where I live and I want to witness for Jesus. So I said, I'm going to take a commode from the bathroom, okay? And I'm going to put it on my front lawn. I'm going to put the little lid up, and I'm going to write on it, Jesus saved John 3:16. I said, how do you think that is? Oh, you can't do that. I said, why? You just told me that the form and the content, it doesn't matter. The right content is there. What's your objection? Well, you know, it just wouldn't be the right thing to do. Ah, so maybe content and form do have something to say to one another. So I think it's precisely what you're on point, and this is one of the most difficult messages to get through, even to my generation, that there is a relationship. And many people are writing on that. Some of you maybe have read Neil Postman. Neil Postman is probably one of the best ones on this. He has written a book on Amusing Ourselves to Death, Technopoly, in which he has done some, well, he's dead now, but he died, I think, 2000-something. Then there are a number of other people who are picking up on that. Well, I think they make a very, very strong case that, in fact, some are even so bold to say the medium is the message. I don't know that I'm going to go that far. But you've got to have these two in sync. So I say, okay, so you're in a parade for the military. Do we play Pop Goes the Weasel? No, you don't play Pop Goes the Weasel. Why? Because it doesn't fit the environment. So we don't, you know, we have particular music for funerals, and for if we're going to go on a nice date with the wife, you know, what kind of music do we want our restaurant to be playing? I'm amazed at when a plane lands. Do you notice what kind of music is over the loudspeaker? Well, it's not hard rock, I can tell you that. Why? You don't want to excite people. They want to get off the plane. You're trying to calm them down, so you play that kind of a music. I said, suppose you get on a plane and the cockpit door's open and there's a man sitting in there, he's got his cutoffs on, he's got an old cap turned backwards, a scrunchy shirt, and flip-flops. And I'm going, he's going to fly this thing across the Atlantic? There is something to be said about the form and the message it communicates. All right, thank you. That's good. Appreciate your input. I think it's something that's of great importance for us to be thinking about. Of course, I think that way, right? It would be great to have really been able to develop it more, but it kind of gives you a taste. Maybe you think about it a little bit more. And as I've said, Neil Postman, Technopoly, is a great little book that will help you think through some of these things. Okay? Thanks.